Thank you, Mary. Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I don't know if I was going to be here, but I'm here. If you're new here, we're glad that you came to be with us today, and we look forward to spending some time afterward to get to know you a little better. I'm Kathy Converse. I've been here for about 30 years, and I'm a member of the program committee. Prairie is a warm and open community where all who come with open minds and kind hearts are welcome. We honor the richness which diversity brings to our fellowship. Differences in age, abilities, ethnicity, gender expression, family structure, political opinion, and theistic or non-theistic beliefs. We come here to refuel, to learn more about being in a relationship together. We learn how to listen, how to forgive, how to foster trust and compassion in one another, and how to live more socially just lives. Our Sunday services vary greatly and are led by either Prairie members or speakers from our greater community. We suggest you visit us more than once and to enjoy this variety. We're going to, let me get these announcements. Hang on, we've got a plethora of these things here. Okay, there's about 10, so hang on. Please see me if you can. This is from Barbara Fry.
Right here.
Okay, please see her if you can bring a bottle of wine or homemade dessert to Ruth Calden's memorial service, which is on the 25th. The Archives Committee has collected the audio recordings of Fall Sunday services Mike Briggs led or helped to lead, and recordings of some of his musical performances for the Briggs family. These digital recordings will be available to any interested Prairie members who bring a thumb drive or laptop to the meal following Mike's memorial service at FUS today, and that's from 3 to 5 p.m. today, and that's from Bob Park. So if you're interested and have more questions, talk to Bob. Today is the last day to register for the fall retreat. Please turn any payments, if you've already registered, to Nancy Wonderland. Nancy's over there. And also Renee, I'm sure, would help. Please bring pictures or other mementos of the Day of the Dead for the altar at the fall retreat. At the retreat, the Prairie Book Club discussion will be about Thornton Wilder's The Bridge of San Luis Rey. Mary Mullen has an extra copy to lend out. See her if you'd like to borrow it. She's got the ears on back here. Okay. And I just wanted to reflect, which is already in the paper, that, because I just mentioned it, there is a memorial service today for Mike Briggs, a long-term member. It'll be at the First Unitarian Society. It's 3 to 7 p.m. And there's also going to be a memorial for Ruth Calden, another long-term member, on Friday, October 25th at 5:30 p.m. at First Unitarian Landmark Auditorium. And on Sunday, the 27th, there'll be a memorial get-together from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Annex for Rosemarie Lester. So it's kind of a sad week. And, go ahead. I'll do this for next. Holly?
Hello. My name is Holly. I'm the director of religious education here. And I have an announcement, and then Maddie's going to help me with an announcement. Please mark your calendars for Sunday, November 24th, to get a head start on your holiday shopping. After service, right out there, the RE Social Justice Gift Bazaar will be going on. The kids have been working on a lot of different projects, and all of the money that we raise is going to be donated to the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, which is an organization that's working to match each child still in custody with a personal legal advocate. So we've already had some other people donate items as well to sell, so there will be handmade items by the kids. If you have things that you have crafted and made and you'd like to donate, you can please see me.
During the month of October, all eight kids are talking about
similarities
and differences between
Universalism,
Unitarian Universalism, and Christianity. Today we will be celebrating the Ten
Commandments.
Commandments and the seven
principles.
Principles. They're all different options, but for people for crafts and
improv.
Improv game to help really learn about these two
ethical
similarities and how we might use them in our real lives. Everyone is welcome to join us at any time. Just head right out the doors and we will be there.
Excellent. Thanks, Maddie. So the RE kids are talking about the differences and similarities between the Ten Commandments and the seven UU principles today. Feel free to join us if you're interested.
Ron Fry has an announcement.
Thank you. I'm a member of the nominating committee, and we are looking for people that would like to be on the minister search committee. The search committee will oversee the process of recruiting, interviewing, and recommending a new minister for Prairie. So pretty important work, and we're looking for a variety of people, newer members, young adults, people with children in RE, older established members, whatever. We hope to get them a slate of people for that committee approved at in December. And probably there's going to be some significant time going into that, but nice to have that time commitment. So If you would be willing to talk to one of our nominating committee members and tell us of your interest, we would appreciate that. Otherwise, we may have to call you. So the nominating committee members are Ron Fry, Kent Wagner, Lynn Curry, and Rebecca Strom. So hopefully you'll be interested.
I think that was everybody that needed to do an announcement. One final announcement. We need a couple of people each Sunday to help clean up our wonderful space that we're using here. There was a sign up as a clipboard with a sign up over there in the coffee area. So if you would please sign up along on Sunday if you can be here to help. Okay, we have started our annual pledge drive. We've received information for a couple Sundays, and you probably received information in the mail. And we are at 43,205 at this current time. So as part of our little pledge drive, we have a special music selection by Dan Proud.
Thank you. Well, growing up, I sang this this hymn in church many times, and this is number 64 in the United Methodist hymnal. Except this is an old tune called Nicaea with music by John B. Dykes from 1861, and the words by Reginald Haber have been modified by Bill Donovan for the 1992 General Assembly. So I suppose this is number 64A. It's not holy, holy, holy. Money, money, money. Our church needs your money. We won't grow unless you give enthusiastically. Taint like milk and honey, budgeting your money. When your offerings impress us underwhelmingly, you know we're not wealthy. Pledge us, keep us healthy. Please pledge with love and generosity. Unlike the boll weevil, money's not an evil. All we need is just enough to pay bills easily. Income, moolah, money makes our outlook sunny. Starts off our week ecclesiastically. Money, money, money. Our church needs your money. We won't grow unless you give enthusiastically. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Our opening words this morning are Ron Fry's going to share them with us.
These words are by Abigail Adams. Well, knowledge is a fine thing, and Mother Eve thought so, but she smarted so severely for hers that most of her daughters have been afraid of it since.
Our opening song is 109 in the songbook, As We Come Marching, Marching with Mary Playing.
Marching in the beauty of the day.
Stockdale will do the chalice lighting.
We hallow this time together by kindling the lamp of our heritage by Albert B. Lander.
Okay, we're going to have now a story for all ages. Nevertheless, she persisted. And Robin is going to read it. What chair?
No, it'll be pretty quick. Okay, so we have some other young people, or are they already out?
No, we're here.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't think they heard us.
Oh, if any kids want to see the pictures, come up. It's actually called She Persisted by Chelsea Clinton. And if any of you don't remember what that comes from, it'll come up in my talk in a little bit. But I'm just going to mention a few people who are in this book. And the very first one is Clara Lenwick. The song that we just sang was about women and men who wanted to make life better for people who work making clothes over 100 years ago. And she was one of them. Is this not on?
I don't know.
No, it's not on. Are you going to continue trying the button?
I thought so. Okay, let's try that. Okay, is that better? Yeah. Okay. So Clara Lenwick was an immigrant who came and worked making clothing. They had to work very long and hard. It seemed like the boss wanted them to become a machine. There was a meeting, and the leaders, who were men, were discussing what to do. And she said, "I'm one of those who suffers from the abuses described here, and I move that we go on a general strike."
I think the battery's dead. So
yeah, she's not coming. Stop staying on. Oh, all right. Where's the other one? Here. Okay. All right. So then another woman. Is that on? Okay. Margaret Chase Smith was a U.S. representative and senator, and she was the only one in the room, often only woman. She wanted women to have more opportunities, including in the military. Also, the New York Times yesterday mentioned that she spoke out against Joseph McCarthy years before many of her other people in her party did. And she also supported science and space exploration.
The head of NASA noted that we might not have put a man on the moon if it wasn't for Margaret Chase Smith. And speaking of a man on the moon, there hasn't yet been a woman on the moon, but Sally Ride always believed women could have any career that they wanted. She persisted, and she became the first American woman in space. She started programs for other girls and young women to learn. So does anybody know what two women did in space this week?
They walked.
Yeah, so there were two women doing space walks. That means they were outside of the spaceships. And that was the first time to have two women having that opportunity. So these are just a few people that persisted in what they wanted. That's our story.
We're going to sing the children out. This is our time when we can share any joys or sorrows, information we want the community to know. Please, there may be many people that want to speak, so don't make it too long, but be sure to say what you want to say.
I'm Nancy Wonderland. I have a loss I want to share about Tom and Cheryl Robinson. Tom's sister, Barbara, who passed away this week. She had been in a nursing home. She'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's and whatever, so years ago. So I have a card that I'll be sending around if you'd like to send.
Thank you.
A friend of our of Robin's and mine, Clint Faust, is here today. He's going to have to leave early, so he won't be here for welcoming. It's a joy for us for Clint to be in town. He's our financial advisor for many years and a good friend. And, so we're happy
to welcome.
Hello, my name is Aaron Pavel. We're new. This is Maddox. Say hi. I've got a joy that I've been sitting on for like 2 months because I haven't had the venue to say it, and so I really need to say it, and I really need to say it in the UU Church. I am a high school teacher at Wanakee High School, and we just had our homecoming game. Homecoming, of course, has a homecoming court, which is traditionally a cisnormative popularity contest. This year, they changed it so that all of the student organizations, including the Gay Straight Alliance, sent someone to the court, and it was chosen, and that the two royals were chosen at random, instead of by couples. And I was just ridiculously excited about that, and I had to tell somebody. I had to tell somebody that would understand. Thank you.
Well, my joy is that this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Mary and I have gone to a number of the book presentations at the Wisconsin Book Festival, and it's been each one of them was great. But we were at the main library, and then we walked down to the Discovery Institute and heard another book talk. But while we were there, or all day, I guess, on Saturday, they had, I think they have it every monthly, a science program that invites the community there to, is very child-oriented, you know, it's to, like, interest young people in science. And I just had a great time walking around looking at it before the book was festival part of it. And they had one display where they had a table of doctors.
You could introduce
and,
me.
And each one of them
the
was sitting
right to
here
the presentation.
Next
that makes
to
sense?
An actual human organ. And I was like, oh, what are these? And they had like all the organs, but they had a tray of hearts, and one was big, and one was normal size, and then one was in the middle. And so I was asking this doctor about those, and because my brother and sister have had heart valve surgery in the last 5 years. And so the doctor was showing me the place where this big heart had valve replacement surgery and the stitches in it and stuff. And she said, and I said, well, but they had a valve replacement. She goes, well, the things could go wrong with the heart. So anyway, it was very interesting.
Well, I have a concern, and I'm wondering if anyone knows something that could help me, whether Linda Sheehy and Mechie Butler have been offered a ride to the two memorial services this week. If you know that they have, then I don't have to worry about it. If they haven't, then I'm willing to bring them today to Mike's, and I will find out whether they can actually go. But I can't get them on Friday, so if you would be willing to take them on Friday, if they're able to go, please let me know.
Well, I have a joy. I don't know how many of you know about Duck Soup Cinema, which is an overture with a show of silent movies. It's sponsored by Goodman Jewelers, and before they make the showing, they have a drawing for prizes, and I won the grand prize. But my joy is, it was a pair of beautiful earrings. My joy is that Pam has agreed to take them, so I don't have to have my ears pierced.
My name is Evelyn Kane. I have a sandwich of joys and sorrows and so forth. First of all, I'm joyful because we discovered Unitarianism. It hasn't even been a year ago, kind of by accident, as things happen in life. And we're happy to have found this nice, warm congregation. I'm sorry, we're going to be leaving on Wednesday. We won't be back till April, but then we'll be joining another nice, warm, small community like this one in Rancho Mirage. So those are my toys and sorrows in the sandwich. I have my new hip, which is such a joy. The last time I was here was in May, I believe, and I was in a lot of pain. I ended up getting a steroid injection, which went the opposite way. And when you get a steroid injection, you can't have surgery for 3 months because it increases your chance of infection. So I'm here. I missed being in the fold. I'll be at the retreat, so I hope everyone will be there so we can catch up.
Okay, we'll have a moment of silent meditation. I failed in my job. I didn't light the candles, but I just lit one candle for all of the thoughts that were said and not said. So today we're very fortunate, and we have Robin Proud back with us. We're so lucky here at Prairie that we can benefit from her endless reading and her wonderful sense of humor, and also her curiosity about all the people that preceded us. She has brought to us information on so many people that I know I had never heard of, and I'm sure many of others, who were people who were exceedingly significant in a lot of the changes, particularly social justice changes that have occurred. So another factor is she has spent decades, I shouldn't say decades, I guess it's decades, working with the Toastmaster groups. So in addition to her reading, research, she's also a wonderful speaker to listen to. So today we have Robin Proud.
Working now?
Yeah, I think so. She's good. Extra
batteries. I was going to say, you note on here she's going to start with a reading from Good and Mad.
Okay, so make sure it's green and then we're good.
technology. Okay, ooh, that's off. Okay. Okay. All right. Good and Mad was written by Rebecca Traister, who was someone that you probably see on public TV or heard on the radio. And this was written in 2018, but she talks about the, we don't need this one, she talks about the history of women's anger in the U.S. Women so angry at slavery and lynching that they risked their lives and reputations and pioneered new forms of public expression for women, including speeches in front of mixed gender and mixed race audiences. Women so furious at their lack of a franchise that they walked 150 miles from New York City to Albany to petition for the vote, went on hunger strikes and picketed outside the White House, so angry that they stayed angry for the decades it took to get the right to vote. It's about how young girls laboring in the Lowell Mills saw in their own situation a similar reflection of the insurgent rhetoric of the American Revolution as they staged walkouts that would become one of the first iterations of the American labor movement, and how a 23-year-old labor organizer named Clara Lemlich, who we saw in the picture book, who'd already been beaten for her participation in earlier strikes, grew impatient with all the talk from men at a meeting at Cooper Union in 1909 and stood up to call for a general strike that became the great uprising of 20,000 shirtwaist workers and resulted in new labor agreements with many factories in New York. And that's where our song refers to.
Be careful, you got your speaker cord in your...
Oh yeah, I got too many things on here.
Take your glasses off and then...
Yeah, I'm tangled up.
Yeah, there you go.
All my aids. All right. So, I had two ideas, basically. As Kathy mentioned, I have often talked about women from our Unitarian Universalist heritage, and many of them, we've heard the names, but we didn't know anything about them, or we never heard of them at all. Not too long ago, I gave a talk about women from the revolutionary times that I called founding mothers. We have founding fathers, and they were founding mothers, but I didn't include Abigail Adams because she is very well known. And then at the same time, I was interested in the fact that several books came out in 2018 about women's anger. This one, Good and Mad, a book called Rage Becomes Her by Soraya Chemaly, a collection of essays called Nasty Women. And these books pinpoint the emotion that fueled the Women's March of 2017 and the Me Too movement and other current phenomena. And when I talk about historical women, I always try to tie it to current issues. So I decided to focus on some parts of Abigail Adams where she spoke up and see if we can get these two subjects to go together. Abigail was born Abigail Smith. In 1744, she was the daughter of a Congregational minister. She was educated at home with, and there was very little education available for girls. She later said, "It is really mortifying when a woman, possessed of a common share of understanding, considers the difference of education between the male and female sex, even in those families where education is attended to. Nay, why should your sex wish for such a disparity in those whom they one day intend for companions and associates? Pardon me, sir, if I cannot help sometimes suspecting that this neglect arises in some measure from an ungenerous jealousy of rivals near the throne." That is, perhaps men do not want women to get too smart because they might want to share some of their power. She was allowed to read from her father's library, which she did, and she also had a tutor named Richard Cranch. Cranch one day brought over his friend John Adams. It wasn't love at first sight, but from the beginning they admired each other's intelligence. They married when Abigail was 19 and John was 28. Their first child, Abigail, but always called Nabby, was born 9 months after the wedding. In all, Abigail was to have 6 children, of whom one was stillborn and one died before the age of 2, which was a very common ratio at the time. You probably know that John Adams spent many years away from home. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Conventions, he was a congressman, and he was a diplomat overseas. He and Abigail wrote copious letters, so this was very good for posterity because they were away and had to write so much. They're probably the most documented in history. They both wrote about philosophical and political ideas as well as their everyday family concerns. John's absences meant that Abigail managed the farm, the servants, the property, and some business ventures. She made her own decisions. In 1774, as the British military presence was ramping up around Boston, John wrote from Philadelphia, urging Abigail to move all his books and papers to their Massachusetts farm, Braintree. She wrote back, "You mentioned the removal of our books, etc., from Boston. I believe they are safe there." So she was confident in her own ability to assess the situation, and indeed there wasn't a problem. She famously asked John to send her some pins. This wasn't because she was a housewife who had to sew for her family. Seeing that this commodity was in short supply, she set up a successful business. While John was away at the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, Abigail at home in Massachusetts was at ground zero for the lead-up and start of the Revolution. She took her 7-year-old son, John Quincy, to watch from a distance the Battle of Bunker Hill. She was 100% for the Revolution. In her famous letter of 1776, she wrote to John, "I long to hear that you have declared an independency. And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Put it out of the power of the vicious and the lawless to use us with cruelty and indignity. All men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." It's hard to tell how much of Abigail's letter was intended to be humorous with its reflection of the grievances of the colonies and the representation issue. Her husband took it that way, humorously. He jokingly compared her rebellion with unsettled behavior among various populations, and he claimed that women really ruled the roost. "Our masculine systems are little more than theory. We dare not exert our power in its full latitude. We are obliged to go fair and softly. To repeal our masculine systems would completely subject us to the despotism of the petticoat." Overall, his reply was, "I cannot but laugh." Both Adamses had their eye on the future of the Republic, and they knew themselves and their offspring as models. When John asserted the importance of statesmen and philosophers in the new American system, Abigail reminded him that mothers were the first educators. "If we mean to have heroes, statesmen, and philosophers," she wrote, "we should have learned women." In 1778, Abigail received from her cousin John Thaxter a newspaper account of a statue erected in London. Reverend Thomas Wilson had placed a statue of the English historian Catherine Macaulay in his church. He called her a prodigy. The inscription said, "Once in every age, I could wish such a woman to appear as proof that genius is not confined to sex." Abigail replied that Reverend Wilson has sullied the glory of his deed by the narrow, contracted spirit which he discovers in his inscription. How he could wish that but one woman in an age might excel, because he said there should be one woman like this in every age. How he could wish that but one woman in an age might excel, and she only for the sake of a prodigy, that is, an exception. She would be the one woman. What must be that genius which cannot do justice to one lady, but at the expense of the whole sex? And in the same letter she wrote on education, "Every assistance and advantage which can be procured is afforded to the sons, whilst the daughters are totally neglected. Why should children of the same parents be thus distinguished? It is really mortifying." This letter happened to be written a day after a momentous event in Abigail's life. In February 1778, when the outcome of the Revolution was highly in doubt, John Adams and his 10-year-old son, John Quincy, sailed for France. John's assignment was to seek help from the French for the colonists. Abigail wanted to go, but the danger of a possible pregnancy and childbirth was real. This was their first lengthy separation, without regular mail. When John was in Boston, New York, or Philadelphia, they could write regularly. Now everything had to go by sea, and this was a time when the British were seizing and sinking ships. And even if the mail worked, it would be a very long time before you got a response. So with this distance and delay, Abigail often had to make decisions about the farm and family without John's input. The travelers returned to Boston eventually, but within a year, John set sail again, this time with two sons. He was sent to negotiate the peace treaty with England and to obtain a loan from the Netherlands. Back home, Abigail continued to speculate on the place of women in the new republic. She deplored the fact that half of the population was, she said, deprived of a voice in legislation and obliged to submit to those laws which are imposed upon us. Excluded from honors and from offices, we cannot attach ourselves to the state or government from having held a place of eminence. This quotation is less known, but I think it's more radical than Remember the Ladies. She seems to be asking not just for consideration, but criticizing a flaw in the new democracy and saying, I think that women should be part of the government. And this time it was 5 years before Abigail saw her husband and those two sons again. She was able to join them finally. The family was in Paris for a while, and then John was named minister to England, and they were in London. Finally, when they returned to Massachusetts, Washington was chosen as the first president, with Adams as vice president. The capital at the time was still in Philadelphia. Although Abigail at first lived there with John, the expense of their travels and entertaining led her to return to the farm, so again she was running various enterprises while he was off in politics. Now, George and Martha Washington, of course, were the first couple, but this was sort of an afterthought. George was a military man. Martha had already been a wealthy widow when she married him. But John and Abigail had spent their lives preparing for citizenship and leadership in this new country. Now, I'm going to skip over a few things. For instance, Abigail was not at all progressive on the view on immigration. She backed her husband on the Alien and Sedition Acts, which did things like lock up people who dared to criticize the president. But so when Washington declined to run again after two terms, it was clear that John Adams was the Federalist candidate, while the Republicans nominated his former friend and now rival, Thomas Jefferson. Abigail, of course, wanted her husband to be given his due. He had prepared his whole life for this. But she also feared the public nature of her role. She said she would have to look at every word before I utter it and to impose a silence on myself when I longed to talk. By the rules of the time, the first place finisher, John Adams, became president, with his rival Jefferson as vice president. You can imagine how well that worked. Or you can see Hamilton, which covers that too. So it was both a blow and a relief that Adams didn't have enough support for a second term. About Abigail's later years, Woody Holton, in his biography, writes, Abigail Adams' biographers sometimes claim that she mellowed during her final years. It is a beguiling image, but it is a myth. The truth is that in old age, Adams tried harder than ever to manage the world around her. Her incontrollable attachment to the superintendence of every part of her household, as her husband said, worried him, so she was a micromanager. John ought to have realized, she said, that domestic... biographer says, John ought to have realized that domestic labors that exhausted her body refreshed her mind. And she wrote to her sister in 1811, I am really so self-sufficient as to believe that I can do it better than any of my family. What a shame it would have been if Abigail had lived all her life under the thumb of a father and husband who kept her only to look pretty, bear children, and supervise a few servants. She might have succumbed to depression and bitterness like Julia Ward Howe, who's another person I spoke about. Instead, John continued to discuss issues with his wife and to ask her to review his letters before he sent them. And in her late years, she wrote some things about how she supported the new pastor, William Ellery Channing, who was one of our founders of Unitarianism. Abigail died in 1818 at the age of 73, 3 days after her 54th wedding anniversary. This was 7 years before her son John Quincy was to become president, and 8 years before John Adams was to die on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, and also the death date of his friend and enemy, Thomas Jefferson. At her death, Abigail did something striking. She wrote the following: I, Abigail Adams, wife to the Honorable John Adams of Quincy in the County of Norfolk, by and with his consent, do dispose of the following property. By law at the time, there was no need for this, as the husband automatically owned all the property of the marriage. Although she mentions her husband's consent, the idea that she had a choice in her bequests was radical, but it was only fitting, since she had spent her life creating and managing the family legacy, both economic and political. This is a really short précis of Abigail, and I'm going to add something else about today. The book that I, one book that's written about her, which won a prize, Abigail Adams by Woody Holton, and there's a kind of a degrees of separation thing here. Woody Holton is a historian. He has a sister named Ann Holton. Ann Holton is married to Tim Kaine, who was the running mate for Hillary Clinton, who, of course, was our first woman major candidate for president and mother of Chelsea, who wrote that book. So, so to bring this to today, women's power really showed up at the Women's March, but many of the mainstream political and media figures downplay this. This was a one-day thing for women to go out and have a good time. Rebecca Traister said, to anyone who actually attended the event, the proposition that it was some casually undertaken dilettante party about hats was nuts. The day before the march, I'd been part of a panel about women's resistance at the Washington, D.C. bookstore, where so many people showed up that they had to bar the door. Inside, the conversation had been urgent, tactical, about candidates and which organizations were doing voter registration and fighting gerrymandering. As soon as the march had concluded, its organizers had staged a gathering called Where Do We Go From Here? One story that I love is that there was a local representative of some kind, a councilman or state representative, who tweeted, I hope the ladies are home in time to make dinner. One woman who was his constituent was so annoyed by this, she ran against him that year and won his seat. Abigail would have enjoyed that. And then in October 2017, the New York Times and the New Yorker published very long stories about Harvey Weinstein. And this led to many more stories about men's and women's power in many industries. What happened in the second decade of the 21st century is that women began to rage publicly in ways that made them audible to one another. And as far as the Me Too movement, Rebecca Traister was often interviewed about this. She said, frequently in those months, I was asked about how to address men's confusion and discomfort. How were they supposed to flirt? What if their respectful and professional gestures of affiliation had been misunderstood? Mothers told me of sons worried about being misinterpreted, that they would face unjust consequences that would damage their prospects. The amazing thing was the lack of acknowledgement that these anxieties are the normal state for just about everyone who is not a white man, that black mothers reasonably worry every day that a toy or a phone or a pack of Skittles might be seen as a gun, that their child's very presence might be understood as a threat, and the repercussions might extend far beyond a dismissal from a job and might result in arrest, imprisonment, or execution. Women enter young adulthood constantly aware that their inebriation might be taken for consent, or their consent for sluttiness, or that any understanding of them having been drunk or slutty might one day undercut any claim they might make about having been violently aggressed upon. Women enter the workforce understanding from the start the need to work around and accommodate the leering advances and bad jokes of their colleagues, aware that the wrong response might change the course of their professional lives. Rose McGowan, one of Weinstein's earliest and most vociferous accusers, recalled being asked, as she said, in a soft NPR voice, what if what you're saying makes men uncomfortable? She answered, good. I've been uncomfortable my whole life. Welcome to our world of discomfort. On the political side, in 2018, all previous records were being broken. 309 women by the spring had announced they were running for seats in the House of Representatives, higher than any other time in American history, and nearly twice the number that had run 2 years before. 47 black women were running for federal seats in total, at least 24 of them non-incumbent black women running for the House of Representatives, then home to only 20 black women. And on the individual basis, many women who had never been involved in politics or communities before got involved. Now, most of the people here have been involved for a long time in local community organizations of various kinds, but for many women, this was a totally new thing. And some of them found that they found their people this way. A woman said, "It was the first time since the election that I felt empowered. There's a whole lot of people like me. My favorite slogan," one of them said, "is you are not alone." Woman after woman spoke of how the loud eruption of their rage had brought them into a community they never knew existed. And at the, toward the end here, Rebecca Traister talks about how writing this book about anger, she was concerned would be very detrimental to her mental health. Of course, everyone knows it's not good for us to be angry, right? But that wasn't how she felt. She said, there was something about spending my days and nights immersed in anger, mine and the anger of others, that had been undeniably good for me. It seemed to fly in the face of everything I had ever been taught. And then she said, "Oh yes, I don't longer believe that it was harmful. I returned again and again to a proclamation made by Elizabeth Cady Stanton nearly two centuries earlier that if women would indulge more freely in vituperation, they would enjoy 10 times the health they do. It seems to me they are suffering from repression." And another wonderful angry woman, Molly Ivins, called this sustained outrage. Right now at the Market Square Theater for $3, you can see this wonderful film about her. I think it's called Raise Hell, The Life of Molly Ivins. And one of her last columns before she died of cancer, she talked about how much she enjoyed the fight. Rebecca Traister says, "Having had the rare and privileged experience of having had my anger taken seriously, I no longer believe that it's anger that is hurting us, but rather the system that penalizes us for expressing it." And this could certainly be true of the black community and many other communities. The system doesn't respect or hear it, mocks or ignores it. That's what's making us sick. Consider that white men in the Rust Belt are rarely told that their anger is bad for them. Rather, and correctly, we understand that what's bad for them are the conditions that provoke their frustration. And then the very end, she says, "This particular moment will pass in some way, and you might be tempted then to retreat to a more peaceful life. But I say to all the women reading this now and to my future self, what you're angry about now, injustice, will still exist, even if you yourself are not experiencing it or are tempted to stop thinking about how you experience it and how you contribute to it. Others are still experiencing it and still mad. Some of them are mad at you. Don't forget them. Don't write off their anger. Stay mad for them. Stay mad with them. They are right to be mad, and you're right to be mad alongside them. Being mad is correct. Being mad is American. Being mad can be joyful and productive and connective. Don't ever let them talk you out of being mad again." So I'd be happy to hear some comments or questions. And then you'll have to see there's a little message hidden in the background of this book that you can look at.
We saw a really good documentary, which many of you may have seen, on John Adams, and I think it was originally HBO, but we probably saw it on Netflix. Anyway, it really showed her as a very strong woman, and it showed John as kind of a pesky guy in a lot of ways, too. And John and John Quincy are my fifth cousins.
Oh, my goodness.
We lived in Braintree and Quincy also. I didn't know that movie was out.
Sounds really interesting. If anybody wants to go with me this week, let me know.
I'm so glad you read that book and presented parts of it to us. Anger has been misunderstood, especially in women. And often when someone feels there's injustice, the emotion they have is anger. It is legitimate to be angry.
One of the talks we went to hear yesterday was, I forget her name, but she's a daughter of Fred Phelps, who is the minister of the church in Topeka, Kansas. And there are a series of questions to her. She broke away from the church and is trying to do a reparation kind of work for the damage that her grandfather and church have been doing. And so one of the questions was how she could speak to her family. She had to sneak away as a young woman with her sister, but she was very close to her family emotionally. So it was a lot of the questions about emotions. And, you know, one person asked her, how do you communicate with your family now? And, you know, and she like gave hints on how to like do that communication and be effective.
Well, that is a good point, because anger is used for things that we might not consider, for purposes we might not agree with. So this was a group that would show up at funerals of service people, right? And with hateful messages about homosexuality and other things.
Well,
I'm
praying for people's deaths, and we're happy when some people died.
Well, there were several people who posted things about Elijah Cummings saying that this was God's vengeance that he died, yeah.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Robin. Thank you. We'll now have our offering and offertory. And today we share quarterly, because some of you are, because we share half of our offering every quarter with a group. And the fourth quarter, it's the Street Pulse, which is a monthly newspaper. And so people can buy the newspaper. Mainly people that do this are people who are unemployed or living on the streets. And they buy the paper for 25 cents. And then they sell it back, and the usual donation is a dollar. And you'll see many of these people in Madison, and I always buy a Street Pulse whenever I see them. And so this is a really nice way to help them feel that they're earning, you know, in actively earning some of their money. So this is the group that a quarter of our collection will be going to. And I think Mary's going to be playing for us. Thank you, Mary. We have a moment if there's anyone who's a guest or visitor who didn't get a chance to introduce themselves.
My name is Clint Faust, and I have known Danny and Robin as their financial advisor and also as a friend for many years, and I adore them. some of my favorite people in the world. So it's nice to meet among people that get to enjoy them as well. And thank you, Robin, for your presentation. I'm down here, I'm from the Twin Cities, and I'm down here for my son's basketball tournament. He's on the club basketball team at the university, and I'm going to duck out instead of saying hi to all of you so I can see the tail end of his game. It's his fifth game of the weekend, so I don't feel like it. But it's in the tournament, so it's like, so I got to get there. So, but anyway, I come from a Lutheran tradition. My father's a Lutheran minister and so forth, and I've always said, I think since I first visited your church in Wayzata, the Wayzata UU Church, if I wasn't going to be Lutheran, and there's a chance someday I won't, I'll find my way to UU. I'm with you folks in heart and spirit and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, thank you for being such a warm and wonderful community for me to join today, and also for Danny and Robin. So anyway, thank you for being here. All less is more, right? So.
Okay, our closing song is number 170. We are a gentle, angry people.
We are.
Evelyn will read our closing words.
Arbitrary power is, like most other things which are very hard, very liable to be broken.
That was Abigail Adams also. Thank you for coming. Greet your neighbors. If you have a few minutes, help us with making the space look like we weren't here.